independence. The year made up of more, however, than the year of many natural disasters and casualties. As though to set the tone, engineer crashed in the desert, killing all 82 on board. Also a year of questions. Many of these concern both national and international economies, which in turn might well decide the election. But there were questions, too, about the leadership in China with the death of Prime Minister Zhou Enlai early in the month. And for how long would the bloodletting go on in Ireland, in Lebanon, in Angola? And still unsettled were the many questions about the Mideast, which surfaced early in the UN, where the Arabs wanted to bring the Palestinian Liberation Organization into the debate. Said an Israeli spokesman,
"The PLO is nothing more than a loose coalition of feuding terrorist gangs who have achieved their standing by the muzzle of the gun and who maintain their position by the assassin's bullet with no discipline and with one faction uncommitted by the decision of the next faction."
Nevertheless, the PLO was brought into the debate, and Egyptian UN Ambassador Abdel Maged voiced Arab demands.
"Israel must withdraw from all the occupied territories, including Arab Jerusalem, and recognize the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, not only for the sake of abiding by the numerous United Nations resolutions, but to win acceptance in the Middle East."
But before leaving Israel for a state visit with President Gerald Ford, during which he would address the U.S. Congress, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said,
"We are ready for far-reaching territorial compromises into what we have now. But we can't accept the principle of returning back to the lines that existed prior to the Six-Day War."
But in the UN, the Arabs called for the immediate establishment of a Palestinian state. The United States vetoed the resolution, and U.S. Ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan gave the reasons.
"The United States' negative vote on the resolution was not based on antipathy to the aspirations of Palestinians, but rather on the conviction that the passage of that resolution would not ameliorate their condition nor be the most effective way of addressing the long neglected problem of their future in the context of an overall settlement."
Meanwhile, the White House was in a two-pronged dispute with the Soviet Union and the United States Congress. The subject, Angola, where the Soviets had injected Cuban troops. Said Secretary of State Henry Kissinger,
"Continuation of actions like those in Angola must threaten the entire web of Soviet-U.S. relations. In this sense, both the negotiations and the overall relations are in long-term jeopardy unless restraint is exercised."
Kissinger and Ford wanted to counter Soviet actions with financial aid to the two anti-Soviet factions fighting in Angola. Congress said no. House Majority Leader Thomas Tip O'Neill,
"I think it definitely shows on the part of the Congress of the United States that they want no military entanglement whatsoever in distant parts of the world, particularly as far as civil wars are concerned."
Ford rebuked Congress through his press secretary, Ron Nessen.
"The Congress has stated to the world that it will ignore a clear act of Soviet-Cuban expansion by brute military force into areas thousands of miles from either country. The consequences of this act can only result in serious harm to the interests of the United States."
Shortly, Soviet-backed Angolan forces proclaimed their victory over the pro-West forces. On the domestic side, the president evaluated the State of the Union.
"Just a year ago, I reported that the State of the Union was not good. Tonight, I report that the State of our Union is better, in many ways a lot better, but still not good enough."
He then made this suggestion.
"I now propose that, effective July 1, 1976, we give our taxpayers a tax cut of approximately $10 billion more than Congress agreed to in December."
The next day, he expounded on his budget, designed with the tax cut in mind.
"This is not a policy of the quick fix. it does not hold out the hollow promise that we can wipe out inflation and unemployment overnight. Instead, it is an honest, realistic policy, a policy that says we can steadily reduce inflation and unemployment if we maintain a prudent, balanced approach.
Democrat enthusiasm was restrained. Senator Edmund Muskie.
The president's plans for our economy are penny wise and pound foolish. Under them, America's factories are producing only 3/4 as many goods as they actually could. That means fewer jobs and higher prices. The president says we cannot afford to help Americans find work. I say we cannot, as taxpayers, afford not to.
As this was happening, on Wall Street, the Dow Industrial was climbing from the 850s to over 1,000. January of 76 was a month of much controversy. In Congress, two CIA investigations were causing headlines, said Director William Colby.
CIA's collation of a list of some questionable activities in the domestic field was used as the basis for sensational charges of a massive illegal domestic intelligence operation. In truth, our misdeeds were few and far between.
But stories both on and off the record of CIA activities in Italy, in assassination plots, and in huge unaccounted for expenditures kept coming. Then, former TV correspondent Sam Jaffe made headlines in the Senate hearing, claiming to know of journalists secretly employed by the CIA.
I'm told that Mr. John Chancellor is on the list, Mr. Walter Cronkite, Mr. William Sheehan of ABC, Mr. Lucioffi of ABC are on the list, and there are a number of other names. I'm told between 40 and 200 names.
All denied the allegation, but in February, the CIA promised never again to hire reporters, clergymen, or missionaries. Meanwhile, the House investigation was becoming famous for its leaks of supposedly secret material. Colby complained.
The committee seems neither able to keep secrets nor its agreement. Second, from the draft of the committee report that I've seen and the news stories today about it, I believe it totally biased and a disservice to our nation.
That report pitted the lower House committees against the White House, which didn't want the report released. Committee Chairman Otis Pike.
I do indeed see a cover-up in which, regretfully, I think the Congress is now participating.
But Ford was adamant.
The administration fully intends to safeguard the effectiveness of this agency, the confidentiality of its information, and the lives and honor of its agents and employees.
The House of Representatives as a whole finally voted to go along with the president. Later in February, Ford issued guidelines of what the CIA could not do in the future. But most controversial was this statement.
I will send to the Congress special legislation to safeguard critical intelligence secrets. This legislation would make it a crime for a government employee who has access to certain highly classified information to reveal that information improperly.
Commented Senate Committee Chairman Frank Church.
It seems to me that we're taking a long step toward government by secrecy, and we are seriously impairing the right of government employees to expose unlawful action.
While the discussion about whether or not the House Committee's report should or should not be made public went on, the report itself appeared in a New York weekly, The Village Voice. Soon it was revealed that CBS newsman Daniel Shore had passed on a copy he had somehow obtained. Quickly, a CBS spokesperson had an announcement to make.
In respect of his subsequent actions in arranging for publication of the report, Mr. Shore acted as an individual and, he states, as a matter of individual conscience. In order, however, not to prejudice the important principles involved in the acquisition and reporting on the report, we shall postpone further CBS News action relating to Mr. Shore until all government proceedings have been resolved.
The government proceeding was to institute an investigation of the leak and threaten to call Shore as a witness. It was pointed out that if Shore did not reveal his source, he could be held in contempt of Congress. Shore's reaction?
It seemed to one reporter that paradoxically, do not publish would have been an act of contempt for our constitutional process. To publish, and it makes no difference where, was a recognition of our separate roles. It was the normal and the natural thing to do as a journalist.
There were other names in the news: the death of writer Agatha Christie and singer Paul Robeson, actor Lee J. Cobb, entertainer Eddie Dowling, humorist Frank Sullivan and H. Allen Smith, and singer Lily Pons. An estimated 23,000 were killed when an earthquake hit Guatemala, injuring more than 75,000 and leaving about 1.5 million homeless. In the United States, new life was given to the Franco-British supersonic airplane, the Concorde, when Transportation Secretary William Coleman, after long hearings, announced that it could land at Dulles and JFK airports for a test period.
If we bar the Concorde completely, we may be condemning for all time or delaying for decades what might be a very significant technological advance for mankind.
In Moscow at the Communist Party Congress, Western European communists declared their preference for democracy over the Marxist doctrine, calling for dictatorship of the proletariat. Also, Portugal decided to become a democracy and hold free elections. February and the beginning of March also saw leadership changes. After charges and denials that the State Department was not supporting his Get Tough policy at the UN, Ambassador Moynihan resigned.
I resigned reluctantly and with a divided heart. To return to teaching at Harvard, having spent 13 of the last 19 years in government and realizing that if I were to give up that post, I probably would never return to teaching, which is my profession.
He was replaced by former Pennsylvania Governor William Scranton.
I think we're on the upbend in the United Nations, primarily due to the policy of the President and the Secretary and the activity of Ambassador Moynihan, and I'm proud and happy to be his successor and be the delegate from the President of the United States.
In the Senate, Majority Leader Mike Mansfield resigned and said,
"My wife and I just thought it was time to step aside and let others take our place."
In London, Prime Minister Harold Wilson said he too was stepping down.
"Many things within the economy are now improving, as in my statement, even the moderation in the rise in the rate of unemployment. And furthermore, the counter-inflation policy is fully accepted by the country, and I do not want to interfere by a leadership election with the vitally important negotiation which will start on the budget and will be continuous right through to the summer. Those are the reasons."
And in Argentina, a junta took over after arresting President Isabel Perón on corruption charges. But from Moscow came this. Leonid Brezhnev announced that he had been re-elected as party general secretary. In China, a relatively unknown Hua Kuofeng replaced Zhou Enlai as prime minister. Also in March, Egypt ended its treaty of friendship and cooperation with Russia. Meanwhile, in the United States, courts made news. The New Jersey Supreme Court ordered a new trial for boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter and John Artis, who had been sentenced to life on triple murder charges. The county prosecutor was accused of having withheld evidence in the first trial. Carter maintained his innocence.
"What you are seeing is a person who has been raped of his freedom for 9.5 years. What you're seeing is a person who has become blind in this penitentiary for the lack of proper medical attention. What you're seeing is a person who has been without his wife and daughter for 9.5 years for crimes that he did not, would not, and could not commit."
On the West Coast, newspaper heiress and kidnapped victim Patty Hearst was found guilty of bank robbery. Her lawyer claimed that if she'd been anyone else, she would not even have gone to trial. Prosecutor James Browning disagreed and said of the Hearst family,
"I have nothing but sympathy for them. I have children of my own. I think that Patricia Hearst can still straighten her life out. I hope she does so."
Defense Attorney F. Lee Bailey maintained Patty Hearst's innocence on the basis that her kidnappers had brainwashed her.
"If the process of coercive persuasion is exercised, there is no way to resist it, and the inevitable result is to cut off all communications with the past. In this case, as to Patty, that meant family and friends. It's an inability to communicate because of a combination of shame, fear, and other things that are induced by the process.
9 days after her federal conviction, Patty Hearst was arraigned on state charges of kidnapping, robbery, and assault. And as March ended, so did the case concerning Karen Ann Quinlan, who had been in a coma for almost a year. The New Jersey court granted her parents' request to remove the respirator that was thought was keeping her alive. First, however, doctors would have to state that there was no hope for her recovery. Her parents' reactions?
I broke down and cried. I cried.
The very first thing we're going to have to do is consult the doctors and have a medical conference with the doctors in the hospital. We haven't gotten to that step yet, but we'll be discussing that in the next few days.
Karen Ann Quinlan's death with dignity was expected to come soon. March did see the deaths of fighter Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum and Representative Wright Patman. In April, those of longtime radio star Mary Margaret McBride and right-winger Gerald K. Smith. In Britain, they buried Field Marshal Viscount Montgomery, and remembered were his famous words when he went to Africa to battle Germany's legendary Rommel.
I have ordered that all plans and instructions dealing with further withdrawal are to be burnt, and at once. We will stand and fight here. If we can't stay here alive, then let us stay here dead.
Also, early in April, from Houston, Texas, came this.
Today at 1:27 p.m., en route from Acapulco to Houston by air, Mr. Howard R. Hughes expired. Mr. Hughes was en route to the Methodist Hospital for medical treatment.
Hughes was reputed to be the richest man in the world, and there was amazement that no sign of a will could be found. A 90-city search for one was instituted. But on the labor front, this.
We want our union to do something to get back the money we've lost. We want the union to do something to get us a decent raise. We have to have a cost of living clause with no cap, and we must have sick days. We're the only human beings in the country who don't get sick.
So spoke one of the Teamsters who went on strike. The strike lasted only 3 days. Abroad, there were reports of rioting in China. Socialists won the Portuguese elections, although they did not have a majority. And in Britain, James Callaghan replaced Harold Wilson as Prime Minister.
There can be no lasting improvement in your living standards until we can achieve it without going deeper and deeper into debt as a nation. Well, that sounds a gloomy start, but it isn't all gloomy. Britain's a country which can have a great future. The tasks are formidable, but if we tackle them with energy and with determination and with optimism, we can overcome them.
The much-discussed book of Richard Nixon's last weeks in the White House, The Final Days, by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame, was finally published in full after many excerpts had been made public. Question, was the book accurate? Said one witness.
It appears from what I've heard, and I haven't read it, that it's reasonably accurate.
Not everyone agreed with Ford, however, as the book jumped onto the bestseller list. Ladies made news in April, too, when Barbara Walters went from NBC to ABC on a reported million-dollar contract. Judith Campbell Exner claimed that she had simultaneous affairs with President John F. Kennedy and two reputed mafia leaders. And Patty Hearst was rushed from jail to a hospital, said her doctor.
She was undoubtedly in acute distress. This is a real emergency, and anyone who's ever had a collapsed lung could certainly tell you that they know something big has happened to them.
President Ford made health news of a different kind.
This program will offer every American the opportunity to be inoculated against a swine-type influenza virus. This virus was the cause of a pandemic in 1918 and 1919 that resulted in over 500,000 deaths in the United States, as well as 20 million deaths around the world.
April ended with the crash of a 727 jet from New York as it tried to land at the St. Thomas Virgin Islands Airport. 37 of its 88 passengers were killed, said a witness.
The plane has started to come in, but evidently overshot its landing and tried to take off again. The nose came up, but the back part seemed to catch on a fence that surrounds the airport. And then it crashed right into the roadway, and there was a loud crash and smoke billowed up. It seemed to be an explosion.
The turn of the month also saw the finding of a Howard Hughes will, in, of all places, the offices of the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City. Many immediately questioned the will's validity. One of these, probate investigator W.A. Jones.
Because of the very mysterious circumstances in which this will did appear on the horizon, and no one has volunteered to say who put the will there and who was holding the will, and that alone throws a cloud over it, because wills are usually kept in personal papers of a person's valuable things, you see. That's just the beginning.
And there were other points. Besides leaving 1/16 of his estate to the Mormon Church, Hughes gave away assets he didn't own in a handwriting that aroused the suspicion of handwriting experts. Finally, named in the will was a gas station owner, Melvin Dumar, who supposedly met Hughes one time. Dumar, who had once been tried for forgery, disappeared, then held a press conference.
First, I was quite shocked. I didn't believe it. In fact, I still don't believe it. The last few days has been literally a nightmare for me. Just all the heckling and the news reporters, the... I guess pranksters, people calling from all over the country, and the last few days is any indication of what the future holds in store. I don't know where I'm going.
As May went on, more alleged wills were found. A novelty shop sold do-it-yourself Hughes wills. It was a month of scandals. A cheating scandal widened at West Point, and a Senate subcommittee looked into Pentagon meat-buying practices in Boston. Senator Lawton Chiles was the chairman.
At the time the subcommittee's inquiry began, fraud had become a way of life at G&G Packing Company. Company officials had been paying bribes of $200 a week to the supervisor in charge of inspection. The senior sergeant in charge of the entire Boston branch had been receiving up to $400 a month in payoffs. No housewife is going to pay $4 a pound for frozen top sirloin butt. And I doubt if housewives will pay $1.60 a pound for stew meat or $1.40 for ground beef. But these are the prices that Uncle Sam paid for millions of pounds of meat products within the past year.
And in May, much was happening around the world. In Italy, the government fell, mandating new elections in which it was feared the Communist Party might be the winner. In the Philippines, six Muslim separatists hijacked a jet. Three of them and 10 of their hostages were killed when troops attacked the plane. In the Middle East, Syria agreed to extend the United Nations observer force on the Golan Heights. And Africa had been moved to the front burner. In a controversial trip there, Kissinger had said,
"The future of Africa must be shaped by Africa. I'm not here to line up one group of African nations or one group of African movements against another. We believe that the problems of Africa and the aspirations of Africa can best be achieved through the unity of African nations and African movements."
He also urged Rhodesia to institute majority rule. At home on the campaign trail, Ford backed him up.
"We're trying to end the radicalism which has developed in South Africa since the Soviet Union and Cuba took over Angola. And the way to do that is to convince the independent states in South Africa that there should be no outside power controlling that part of that continent. And at the same time, we have to believe, because it's historically the right thing in this country and what we've believed in, of majority rule with the absolute protection of minority rights."
Forbidden by local actions from using a New York airport, the supersonic jet Concorde began landing at Dulles outside of Washington. First, it brought over French President Giscard d'Estaing. Then a week later, the British and French began a regular schedule of 5 round trips a week. Finally, the Soviet and the United States signed another nuclear treaty. Although he had delayed the signing until after the Michigan primary election, President and candidate Ford defended that treaty.
"The new treaty, together with the Threshold Test Ban Treaty, will govern the conduct of every underground nuclear explosion for military or peaceful purposes for both parties. The two treaties impose the same limit of 150 kilotons on all individual underground nuclear explosions. The ultimate purpose of the network of arms control agreements we have already negotiated and which are currently being negotiated is to bring about a more peaceful world."
But at the end of May, as at the beginning of the year, killings were continuing in Ireland. Lebanon, despite uncounted ceasefires, was still torn by civil war, and Africa seemed on the verge of blowing up. both Italy and Central Asia were hit by violent earthquakes. In our nation's capital, however, sex was also making the headlines.